Hello, hello, and miscellaneous third greeting. This is Material World. I'm Quentin Cooper, and you are welcome, pod person, to it, unless for some reason you object to anything in the terms and conditions. Go to bbc.co.uk/radio4 to see if you do. Today, parasites and pyrosophy. Parasites being, despite their deserved bad reputation, among the most ingeniously adaptive forms of life on the planet. We'll look at why later. And pyrosophy, or pyrosophy, being what comes between blueprint and blue watch, or, as the OED defines it, knowledge of the nature and properties of fire, which is pretty much a prerequisite of successful structural fire engineering. For many new buildings being constructed, and some old ones already in use, much scientific and technological effort is now going into minimising the risk of them going up in flames and maximising the odds of survival if they do. Yes, there's the obvious stuff about adhering to building regulations and avoiding indoor barbecues, but there's a lot that's not so obvious or so predictable. With moves towards using new materials in new combinations, demands for increased energy efficiency, and a pressure for bigger and more ambitious designs, it's become vital to know how a planned structure is likely to behave in the unlikely event of a fire. Finding out after it's been built can be too late. See Towering Inferno for details. Or, if you prefer a real-world example, think of 9/11 and the collapse of the World Trade Center, which belatedly changed our understanding of how steel and other materials deform during a fire. Because the way we keep building is rapidly evolving, research in this area is always right at the cutting, or perhaps I should say searing edge, and Dr. Barbara Lane, Associate Director at ARUP, has just been awarded the Royal Academy of Engineering Silver Medal for her work, which has been used to help reduce fire risk in some of the world's best-known buildings. Barbara joins me here in the studio, and Dr. Luke Bisby, Senior Research Fellow in Structures in Fire at Edinburgh University, is in our Edinburgh studio. Barbara Lane, just to establish your credentials, I say world well-known buildings. What are some of the well-known buildings you've helped lessen the risk of fire for?
Well, some topical ones are, for example, some of the buildings going up on the Olympic Park that are now finished in Beijing, or maybe what they call the Gherkin in London, also known as Swiss Re.
Right, that's a pretty good start. And given the right or wrong circumstances, can any structure potentially burn down?
Yeah, I think the thing about designing structures for fire is accepting and being aware of the power of fire and what it can do, and detailing your structure so it can withstand that force or that power. And once that acceptance is there, there's a lot of clever things that can happen to make the building safer and respond better in fire.
OK, we'll go on to some of the details of that. But, I mean, Luke Bisby, this realisation that home and hearth can potentially be one and the same must go back hundreds of years. But how long have we been building with that in mind, and even more importantly, designing with that in mind?
Certainly, I would say the initial attempt to account for fire from a structural point of view in our buildings would go back to the early 1900s, probably in its earliest conception. And then really not a whole lot happened that was new in terms of how people were designing for fire in the structural situation until there were some situations that occurred in the late 80s, early 1990s with the Broadgate fire, which really changed our understanding of how certain types of structures behaved in fire, and that we had to look at the way the full structure behaved in fire as opposed to just looking at specific structural members.
So, Barbara, is structural fire engineering about learning from previous mistakes? You see a building burn down, you think, how could we have built it better? Or is it more about imagining and imaging the worst-case scenarios and through a computer or other means, coming up with designs where you think, well, we've eliminated that possibility, we've minimised that risk, we've cut that to the so that it's the least likely to happen?
Exactly. It is about working out what the potential worst case scenario could be in a building, and then quantifying that using very advanced analytical methods, and giving advice then to the design team and the architect about what materials may behave better, how they should be connected together. So it's not all about learning from disaster, it's just quantifying what can happen. And the old approach was not to quantify anything. It was to simply try and keep everything cold. What we're trying to do is accept they get very hot in a fire and make sure they behave very well.
So it's almost like in some jobs they say, you know, the best way to survive is to treat everybody as a fool. In yours, is it almost like you have to treat everything as a fuel, as a potentially something that can feed the fire?
Yeah, no, exactly. And when you're a fire engineer, everything you see can burn, and you do imagine the worst case scenario when you're in a building, because that's how we have to think every day. And sometimes when you're working for a client maybe with a very valuable art collection or something like that, which they care very deeply about, and you constantly refer to it as a fuel load, it can, you know, cause a little bit of tension at times. But that is how we see the world.
In the past, has there been a tendency for it all to be about either sort of afterthought or aftermath? In other words, you know, somebody's there, after it's burnt down, they're realising what they should have done, or it's an afterthought, as in once the building's up there, they then start thinking about how to lessen the risk.
No, I think traditionally, in terms of when you're designing, you have to satisfy what they call code. And traditionally, codes have only ever changed when something's gone wrong. And what we're trying to do, and why we're working so closely with Edinburgh, is think more about the future and address what may happen and make sure the design can satisfy that, not deal with it afterwards. And all the time trying to understand the risks and analysing and quantifying those risks and then detailing a building that will behave well.
Luke, so let's take an example that's very well known. After the World Trade Centre, I mean, OK, yes, it was struck by an aircraft and actually survived as well as people expected it to be when struck by multiple aircraft. But afterwards, how much did we learn from the way the building collapsed and the way it burned?
I think we learned quite a lot from both situations, both in terms of the fire in a building, how the fires develop and spread, as well as in terms of the structural response of the building. I think some of the more significant things to come out of that situation are really highlighting these issues that Barbara and her team and some of the academic community have been identifying since the Broadgate fires in the early 1990s, things like having to consider the full structural response and consider the overall performance of the structure as opposed to an individual structural member, looking at the relationship between what fire engineers would call the active fire safety measures in a building, things like sprinklers and other fire safety systems, and the passive systems in a building, so the fabric of the building and how the building stands up on its own.
Barbara, is this something that we sort of, a version of what we encounter quite a lot across sciences, that a reductionist approach, looking at the individual components and how they can behave, can only take you so far? It's how they act when they're all combined that can change the nature of a response of a building or a structure to a fire.
Absolutely, and that's been the fundamental change. I mean, since the late 1800s, structures were only ever tested at a small scale in a particular heating dose, and the knowledge was based on that. Now, with the advanced computer technology that we have, where we can put vast numbers of structural elements together, thinking of a building the size of the World Trade Center, heating up all those multiple elements, all those different materials, and observing together how they behave rather than in isolation, you see all ranges of much better performance, and also some surprising, unusually bad performance, which you simply cannot see in a small-scale, single-element test or investigation.
But do you literally have to go through the whole range of worst-case scenarios, from somebody working at a computer leaves a cigarette burning to a petrol tanker crashes into the base of the building?
No. Thankfully, we don't have to go through the probably thousands of scenarios that are possible. There are some accepted equations or approaches with respect to working out what they call a reasonable worst-case scenario, and that scenario is meant to represent a situation that what could possibly and realistically happen in the building is always far better than that. And you agree a worst case fire scenario with the approving authority, with your client, with the fire brigade, as being appropriate to that particular building, and that becomes the basis for your design.
And can you characterise what happens to a steel frame based building in a fire?
We can characterise fairly well reasonable worst case scenarios for very severe fires, and then work out what that massive heating dose now will do in quite good detail in complex steel frames. Yes, we can. And that is because there's been such good work done at a full scale in steel buildings, which has helped us validate the advanced tools that are available now to work these things out.
Luke, as we begin to use new materials in buildings, does that help because they're less likely to have certain negative properties, or does it complicate things because now you've got to take all the possibilities of how they are and how they are in combination with other materials into account?
I mean, I think it depends very, very much on the specific material that we're talking about. Certain new materials that are being used in structures don't have too many problems associated with them, and based on previous knowledge, we're quite confident. Other new materials certainly have some problematic behavior associated with them, and so we have to figure out ways to get around those problematic behaviors.
Now, look, this may be an almost impossible question to answer, but I'm going to ask you it anyway. If we were building the Twin Towers again to all the same criteria as before, but taking account of what we now know about using design to minimise fire risks, what would be different about them?
In terms of the actual construction of the buildings, I'm not certain. I mean, my expertise is not high-rise building design, so that's probably going outstepping the bounds of my knowledge. I mean, I know that Barbara's team has done some work looking at that structure. She may want to.
Yeah, well, I think that if what we're already doing as a result of 9/11 is designing the structure where fire is an applied load to the structural systems, just like they do for earthquakes, for wind, for snow, for the people, for all the things they have to carry. And that would be different. That technology was not available when the World Trade Center was designed. It is available now. And by quantifying what the fire could do to a building like that, you're probably looking at changing the way the beams and columns are connected together, changing the geometric forms, you know, making sure the distances between beams and columns are at an acceptable length. So all sorts of little changes, which to the outside observer, probably they can't see, but do allow a far greater intrinsic safety in the final building that the people then occupy.
Does most of what we now know really apply to the grander scale projects, to the office blocks, to the skyscrapers, to the public buildings, or can it actually help with housing design?
No, it applies to absolutely everything. I mean, people just like to talk about tall buildings, but this concept of being able to quantify fire and make materials behave better applies to everything, anything that people are interested in occupying.
Luke, I don't know if this is going to help with this, but I mean, one thing that surfaces occasionally is about intelligent buildings, buildings with sensors built in. Could this help protect our buildings if they're actually physically telling us how they're changing in the event of a fire?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think there's definitely a case to be made with respect to the sensor-rich environments in which we live and the environments in which we already have within buildings where we have, you know, thermal sensors throughout buildings to tell us about the climatic conditions in a building, you know, the heat turning on, the heat turning off, that sort of thing. If those systems are wired into an intelligent network of sensors that can provide information during a fire and let us know about the life safety conditions in a building, then certainly there's some opportunity there. And there are some groups working at Edinburgh, along with AirUp and other partners, to look at those systems.
And Barbara, if the work that you got that won you the silver medal, one of the great findings from it seems to be that a lot of what we were doing to try and protect our buildings, this was money that was actually being used possibly to no avail and may have even been making the problems worse.
Yeah, it doesn't always make the problem worse, but it certainly is not giving what you call value for money, you know, spending money on materials to keep structures cold, which don't guarantee you at all that they'll behave better in fire. So our approach is to spend your money wisely, not protect things just for the sake of it, and make sure that your structural design itself, without this protection, can behave as well as it can in a severe fire
case. So built-in fire prevention
exactly,
rather than bolt-on.
Exactly.
And finally, just very briefly, Barbara, we had people on the programme a couple of years ago talking about fire safety in terms of aircraft, and off-air, down the pub, they were telling me, name by name, individual aircraft that they would not fly in because they consider it risky.
Yes.
Now, I don't expect you to name names, but are there such things as buildings that you consider to be dangerous?
There has been times in my life when I've been in a building and I have definitely left because I don't want to be in there anymore. And I'd never go on a plane anyway. Anyone who knows me knows that. So.
Fine. I'll see you down the pub afterwards for more details. Doctors Barbara Lane and Luke Bisbee, many thanks for allowing yourselves to be flame grilled. And as Fire Chief Steve McQueen says to architect Paul Newman at the end of The Towering Inferno, you know, we were pretty lucky tonight. One of these days, you're going to kill 10,000 in one of these fire traps. And I'm going to keep eating smoke and carrying out bodies until someone asks us how to build them. I think we've reached that stage. There's links to more on that on the Material World web pages within bbc.co.uk/radio4. That's also where you'll find a vast archive of past programmes, all you need to know to sign up for our podcast, and details of how to contact us with thoughts, ideas, criticisms, or even words of encouragement, of which there were many following last week's mention of a bottle which comes with seeds in its cap and designed so that the whole thing, on adding hot water, turns into a medium they can grow in. Alice Tyrrell was particularly enthused.
Brilliant prog today. Teaching about packaging materials to GCSE graphics class can get, well, very stodgy. But the idea that the bottle we're designing will have such a use as a plant pot or similar makes life much more vibrant.
Thanks, although not sure about prog.
As human beings intent on maintaining man's domination over nature, we may regard parasitism as pathological, insofar as it becomes a drain upon human resources. On the contrary, biology teaches us that parasitism is a normal phenomenon, and if we accept this view, we shall be more ready to pay the price of freedom as a permanent and ever-recurring levy of nature for immunity from a condition to which all life is subject.
The pioneering American pathologist Theobald Smith, writing 75 years ago on the normality of parasites. And yet, despite the clear truths behind his statement, that amongst the most adaptive and abundant of all organisms, even parasites have parasites, our view of them remains comprehensively negative. Here's yesterday's PM programme on the contamination of water in Northamptonshire caused by, we were told, Cryptosporidium.
That's a parasite that can cause severe sickness and diarrhoea, and it's particularly nasty.
It is, but even when we treat parasites as a bad lot and do all we can to wipe them out, we're not very good at it. Despite our best efforts, most have survived, many have thrived. Witness the various setbacks in the war against malaria caused by parasites transmitted by mosquitoes. But the normality isn't just about the numbers of parasites, it's about the nature of parasitism. It's estimated that as many as half of all animals have a parasitic phase during their lives, and good luck coming up with a definition of parasite that doesn't seem to apply to at least some humans. So if we are to live with and deal with parasites, do we need to rethink how we view them? We're joined by Mike Boots, Professor of Disease Biology at Sheffield University, and also by Dr. Sarah Rees from the School of Biosciences at Edinburgh University. That makes three people on the programme from Edinburgh, not counting me, who has been looking at how the parasites which cause malaria are so resistant to all our attempts to eradicate them. Sarah Rees, what are parasites besides being particularly nasty?
Well, parasites are organisms that live in or on another organism that we call a host, and they exploit their hosts to get nutrients from them, and by doing this they cause harm to their hosts, and that results in disease, illness and sickness. So that's what makes parasites nasty. They're causing harm to the organisms in which they live.
Right, so it's symbiosis without the positives for the, host.
No positives for the host.
And Mike Boots, are there examples of parasites that we have successfully eradicated?
Really only one, which is smallpox. The smallpox was eradicated by vaccination, but other than that we've been pretty well and successful at eradicating parasites.
Any reason why?
Partly that they're clever, partly that they can evolve and they can adapt in response to the ways in which we try to control them.
So, Sarah, give us examples of how they are quite so adaptive.
Well, so, for example, I work on malaria parasites, and we've recently shown that they're monitoring the environment that they're living in all the way throughout their infections. They're constantly taking in information about the circumstances that they find themselves in and changing the things that they do in appropriate ways to maximise their chances of getting into their mosquitoes. Because, of course, for malaria, they need to get into mosquitoes to be transferred to new hosts. They kind of use mosquitoes like a glorified flying syringe, if you like.
Mosquitoes use it that way. And it may be a daft question, but how are they able to? I mean, if they're just little humble parasites, how are they able to get all this information about their environment and respond to it?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. And it's only very, very recently that we've learnt quite how sophisticated they are. So now we know what they're doing, we can now begin to go in and use the reductionist approach that you were talking about before and actually look at what they're doing and how they're doing it.
Yes, I wasn't dissing the reductionist approach. I'm just saying it only has its limits as well. Mike, as we've been hearing in the last couple of days with the Cryptosporidium outbreak, you can pick up parasites from water. We know that you can pick them up from contaminated food. Are they as versatile in their ways of getting into us as they are in their ways of adapting once they are within us?
Yeah, definitely. From a parasite's point of view, it's in a host and it wants to get to another host, and they can do it in different ways. They can go via vectors, like mosquitoes. They can persist in the environment, or some of them are quite directly transmitted, really bumping into each other. So there's all sorts of different ways in which they can get between hosts.
And also they can hang around for a long time waiting for an opportunity.
So one quite interesting thing about parasite biology is the way that they transmit from host to host can have quite serious implications for how much harm they cause to the host that they're in. So, for example, parasites that need to kill their host in order to leave their host, obviously they have a vested interest in making sure their host dies. So, for example, parasites like anthrax can just hang out in the environment for long periods of time waiting for a new host to come along. Whereas other parasites, like, for example, the cold virus, that sort of has a bit of a vested interest in keeping hosts healthy enough so that they're going out and about and they're interacting with other potential hosts that they can infect.
So it's a sort of grim picture. I mean, it's as if their only interest is in keeping you alive, is if they're thinking, well, it's, you know, I need this person for now. I could kill you, but it's not in my interest to do so. So there's a balance, presumably, between whether they are interested in there's a local population they can infect, or if they've got to operate over long distances, they need the host to survive for longer.
I mean, that's right. I think there's a very nice kind of analogy with forest fires as well. That if
that'll go down well with the first start with Barbara.
If you're transmitting very locally, so you're transmitting within patches, then if you transmit too quickly, you'll use up your fuel, and your fuel in this case is susceptible hosts. So we have a lot of models and predictions that predict that actually, if you tend to transmit over much greater distances, you can actually infect quicker and be more virulent. And so recently we've been trying to test some of these ideas.
How do you test that experimentally without causing an outbreak of something?
Well, this, of course, is the problem. So what we have is we have some laboratory systems. We have this insect virus system in our laboratory where people don't mind that we start an outbreak within our incubators in the lab. And what we have is a system where the insects actually live within their food. They live within this basically a breakfast cereal that we make for them. And we realise that we could make it stickier. So if we make it a little bit more gloopy, the individuals can't move around so much. And we can actually manipulate how much of the infection is happening locally and how much is happening at a distance.
And there is a response to the level of gloopiness, then, is there?
There is. So we found in the gloopiest cases that we found that the virus was selected to actually infect at a slower rate. So it actually did manage its resources a little better due to the fact that it's tending to infect more locally.
And Sarah, you've also been looking in detail at things involving gender within the parasites involving mosquitoes. Their ability to respond to the environment even goes down to the ratios of males to females.
That's right. So when malaria parasites find themselves in mosquitoes, they've produced some special male and female transmission or reproductive stages. And it's the job of these males and females to mate with one another. And only then can they actually infect their mosquito. And therefore, getting the ratio of males to females and their number spot on is crucial to maximise the number of infections parasites can achieve in their mosquitoes. And we've shown that parasites are taking a lot of information and changing the ratio of males to females in very sensible ways according to natural selection to maximise their chances of mating successfully in their mosquitoes.
But I can accept that there might be a good ratio, but why isn't that good ratio the same in all circumstances?
So, for example, as parasites progress through their infections, their hosts have something to say about it and they develop an immune response. And we think that this immune response, we know that it blocks the mating process in the mosquitoes, and we think that these immune factors are much worse for males than they are for females. So they basically hamper the male's ability to mate and not the female's ability. Right. And the parasites seem to be able to detect something like this is going to happen to them, and so they just simply produce more males to compensate.
Mike, there's a lot here that's almost counterintuitive, that, you know, that in terms of if you've got a parasite that's particularly virulent, it may actually wipe itself out because it kills off all its hosts. If we come up with drugs to stop a particular parasite, there's a risk it may actually build up its virulence, so it may have a contrary effect. Is it very difficult to by learning more about the life cycles, are we able to actually come up with better ways of protecting ourselves and of treating ourselves and of coming up with drugs to prevent parasitic infections?
I think we definitely are. We're always in danger when we intervene that we're going to select the parasite in some way. And of course, what we want to avoid is selecting the parasite, making the parasite more virulent. And I think the more we understand about how parasites, what causes parasite virulence and what the response to selection is likely to be, we're going to be in a better position to manage things like drug resistance and stopping any potential interventions making the situation worse.
But do we also need to actually think of them as normal, as we were saying at the start, and not think about the idea of eradicating, thinking more about living with them?
We do have to live with them. We have to live with the fact that they will evolve in response to what we do. We can't have evolution-free treatment, so we have to be able to manage that evolution and live with them. Yeah.
Okay.
By understanding their evolution much better, we can predict what sort of interventions will work in the longer term.
OK, Dr. Sarah Rees, Professor Mike Boots, thank you. Next week, in response to both repeated requests from the material Worldly Wise and to multiple references in Doctor Who, we're looking into the decline of the humble bumble and other bees in the UK and beyond. And without wishing to prejudice the investigation, I'm pretty sure that the reasons solutions we'll come up with will differ slightly from any offered on BBC One on Saturday night. We will also follow in the footsteps of Mulder and Scully as we mark the centenary of the huge explosion at Tunguska in Siberia. Although, again, I'm not sure we'll reach the same conclusion on the X-Files about just what the cause of them was.